Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We're going to be talking about where we are and your yard and your garden and your forest and your pastures. It's what we do on our show. We have a good time doing it. Somebody's going to talk about houses because that's about how we live. And those houses integrate with our gardens, or should. Listen, here's the thing I'm thinking about today, because it got cold last week, did it not? Not, if you want to know how cold it was relative to, well, whatever. There's a great way to look at that. And I highly recommend it. It's the climate plots for Mobile and Pensacola. And you can just, it's as simple as going to the National Weather Service, to the Mobile site, or the Pensacola site, or the Montgomery site, or wherever you are, the Huntsville site, Birmingham, and looking at those climate plots. They're very interesting, and they give you a real sense of how this weather compares to stuff that's happened before. Was it really that bad? Sometimes these cold spells seem to us to be colder than normal. They're only colder than normal compared to what's been happening this year and last year. Within the long span of things, they're actually not colder than normal. It's interesting to look at. There's a whole bunch of interesting things to look at when you look at those climate scans. I just highly recommend it because it tells you a lot about gardening. And it tells you a lot about how you garden. One of the things we're seeing on these climate plots, and it's really, really obvious when you start looking at them, is how things have changed. Last summer was incredibly hot. You can see that compared to other summers. It was off the charts in many ways. But what's also interesting is that October is almost off the charts, being much colder than normal. Wow. And with more days that are very cold, and March, April in the past few years have been that way too. It could change the way we garden. We're going to have to think about it, but it's really interesting to look at it. Don't take my word for it. You go look at it. It's just really pretty simple. It's just the data from the weather station laid out there. And we've got a lot of data from Mobile and Pensacola because we've been keeping temperatures there for a long time. Really interesting. So what's going to happen for your gardening? We have this week, this month, the past two or three months, we've been hearing from various gardening sites about a new horticultural map, a horticultural zone map, a climate zone map for gardeners that tells you what kind of plants you can grow where. So you might see when you look in a catalog, you might see something that says zone 8 or zone 5 through 7. And this is based on those horticultural zones. And I would tell you to memorize those zones, except I just want to say right off the bat, those horticultural zones have always been a really goofy way of looking at climate. And they tell you almost nothing about how you garden. What's interesting about the latest horticultural zone map is that it puts almost every city in Alabama about 100 miles south of where it was 15 or 20 years ago. It's as if, according to the horticultural zone map, Montgomery could be growing what we used to grow in Mobile, and Birmingham could be growing what we used to grow in Evergreen, and Huntsville is growing what used to be only grown in the coastal plain. It's really interesting. And You've been reacting to these changes too. This map is showing something happening because you're increasingly prone to plant things like limes, I hear it all the time, or grapefruit, and there is some success. But then you look out the door on a very cold week like last week and you say, ooh, boy, this ain't right. And those horticultural zone maps have never been right because here's why. They always pick one number. One day and one number each year, and they average it all out, and that one number is the coldest day of the year. So that means that if you're gardening in Zone 8 in Alabama, which people in Birmingham are, that means you should be able to grow the same things they're growing in Zone 8 in California. Give it a try, folks. It ain't going to happen. Those numbers have always been useless. Now, the way they're being presented makes it even harder for us to understand what our gardens are going to be like, what climate is going to be like, how do we adjust to it? Because always the issue is, what are our seasons? Not just one number, not just one week, not just one week of cold, but what is happening the whole year in our gardens? That's what we have to build around. Now, sometimes one week can make all the difference in terms of certain plants, as happened last week. If you were trying some very, very tropical plants like limes, it's quite likely that they didn't take it well when temperatures got down to 17 degrees or 19 degrees. It's not the coldest temperature ever in Mobile or Pensacola by any means. It's just that we're so used to warmer winters now that when we get these flash cold, we actually do things that are a little not quite appropriate, like planting limes outside. But not only that, we've gotten used to it, and then suddenly, boom, it just does a number. It's interesting. We're studying this. We're thinking about this. I'm thinking about it not as a scientist so much as a gardener and thinking, how am I going to adapt to this? And there's some pretty successful things I've done. Even that work down to single digits for winter, and that's something we're going to have to adjust to. And it's very easy. We just got to think about it. Something to think about it. The new horticultural zone maps, ignore them. Let's think about what our seasons are. What are our seasons going to be like? When do we really need to start planting? Do we start planting at the same time as people in Boston? No, I would recommend that that's not a good idea. At the same time, we're not Orlando. We're not Miami. Not at all. So where do we find ourselves? Here in Alabama. What's the climate like? What are the temperatures going to be like? What's the rainfall like? It's one of the big things that horticultural map has always missed. Why is California different than Alabama? Anybody got a reasonable idea? Yeah, and I know you got all those kind of things about people and all that, but let's think about landscapes. Let's think about places. Let's think about what makes a place distinctive, because that's what gardens are about. Why is it different? It's different because it doesn't get nearly as much rainfall. That's the biggest difference. It's huge. It's major. I mean, Los Angeles is getting, what, less than 12 inches of rain a year. Mobile is getting 70 inches of rain a year. That's a big, big difference, and it changes everything. It changes humidity. It means it's more humid here. It means the night temperatures don't drop as quickly. It means that they stay warm during summer. All those things happen, so we have to be really careful about those horticultural zone numbers. You're given permission to totally ignore them as much as you can, because they're not right, and somebody ought to finally clobber that system and knock it in the head and get rid of it, because it just does not work for us at all. How do we figure out what we're doing? Well, let's start here by looking at these climate plots for Mobile and Pensacola. Really interesting stuff, even in terms of rainfall. It's fun to look at sometime. We'll talk a little bit more about it.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Yeah, if some magazine, if somebody on the internet, if some catalog tries to engage you in a discussion about horticultural zones, and you just tell them, nah, it doesn't capture what's going on. And, you know, climate, when it changes, and it does, maybe happening now a little faster than usual, it's not really about a single number. It's not really about how hot it was during a single day. It's not even really about daytime temperatures in the South. It's really about nighttime temperatures throughout the year. That's what makes the big difference in terms of climate change. And you don't often see people talking about the nighttime temperatures, do you? But you ask me why that makes a big difference. It does. It's the big one. But the horticultural zone map doesn't capture any of that. And so it's kind of useless. And it's really distracting our conversation about how we plan for our gardens. And I'm just giving you a heads up. I'm going to have to say this many times before we really begin to adapt. It's a big battleship out there, and it's kind of hard to turn it sometimes. But we are going to have to think about how our climate's changing and how we're going to adapt to it. And that's one of the things why I'd like to get you used to looking at this really cool graphic, climate plots for Mobile and Pensacola. Look at the rainfall sometime on there. It's interesting. Go back to, well, you don't have a complete year for 2024, but if you go back to 2023 and you can kind of look at how our rainfall works, and it is not the way rainfall works in most other cities. You see that big hump in July and August? That's kind of weird. That's kind of amazing. And September. That's odd. Most places, it's actually drying out in July, August, and September. That's why Mobile and Pensacola are so odd. And that graph shows you that very clearly. It's really interesting. And it also shows you how each year may vary from another year. And that's very interesting, too. So it's really worth looking at. Jim in Georgetown is keeping up with his numbers. He thinks, Jim, are you thinking it's 16? If it was 16 degrees out in Georgetown, that seems reasonable. Going to be a little colder than the airport. It's one of those temperatures you'd rather not see if you're growing citrus. So, Jim, I'm curious to see how they've done. I do think that they were probably, the good thing is they may have been somewhat dormant when that happened. They may have been pretty dormant, and they may have been shut down, and you may get less damage. So it'll be interesting to see how your flower buds come out this coming year. We'll have to go through that whole thing, Jim, that we always do. And I think, Jim, I'm just going to put you on the air so that you can remind people what I will tell them when they ask me, should I prune this back now? Jim's got it figured out, folks. Jim waits, and it makes a big difference. He's shown me the pictures. Let's just wait on it. Let's see what happens. It was not good. 14, 15, that's really bad. That's really when satsumas start taking it on the chin. 16 is really tough on a lot of oranges. It's probably not as tough on something like Hamlin as it is on Naples. So it's interesting. I'm interested to hear about grapefruit. Did the grapefruit freeze on the tree? I advise some folks to go ahead and take it off. Some people, and I said, look, you don't want to take it all off, take half of it off. You'll have half and see what the other half does. Grapefruit usually doesn't really get its top quality flavor until about February, and that's the best time to pick. It's going to be developing decent flavor now. Go ahead and pick it. Little premature. But I'm interested. But the question is, what happened to the rest of the grapefruit? Pretty sure those satsumas froze up pretty good. pretty sure we had some Lyme damage, and maybe some damage on Meyer's Lemon, which is a little hardier than most because it's an orange hybrid. So let me know what you're seeing in your yard. Let me know what you're seeing around your yard. Got a bunch of questions this morning that I came into early. They're really about lawns, and it's that time of year, I reckon. Someone said, you know, this really isn't about gardening, it's about lawns. And that's an interesting and telling, a very telling subject line, isn't it? Lawns are good for gardens if you don't let them get out of control, the lawns. And by out of control, I mean you don't have too much of it. It's great for getting around from one place to another. It should not be the jewel of the garden. If you want the lawn to be the jewel of the garden, oh, I just should tell you, I probably am not going to be able to help you. I'm not sure anybody can, honestly. It will always be a pain because lawns, big lawns, are just not natural in any kind of way. They can't cope because they're big monocrops, whatever you want to call them. They're just one big, massive bullseye for insects and pests. And so you need a little bit of diversity in your yard, at least. That's one of the problems with lawns. Okay, let me get to this. The first question was, somebody said, I've got armadillos nosing around in my yard, making divots, and I got holes in my yard. I noticed this in my pasture, too. And what I want to do is I want to till the whole thing up. No, don't do that. Do not do that. If you've got good grass, leave it be, because it's going to be hard to reestablish anything else. If your grass is in good grass, how do I define that? Green? If it's green when it's supposed to be green, most of the time, you're fine. Even if it's not just one kind of grass in there, that's okay too. That's not a big deal. If you've managed to keep your centipede alive or whatever, I'm just amazed, because it's hard to do. But if your lawn is okay and you've just got a few divots in it, deal with the divots. Don't destroy your lawn in the process, because it will be very hard to get it started again. I also think, by the way, that tilling is the wrong thing to do. Always the wrong thing to do. Never, never, ever. Tilling destroys the lawn in some very important ways, and it will not resolve the problems. Any problems you have with your lawn, it won't resolve them. It will make it worse. And we can go into the gory details of why that is, but it is. It's just true. It's like you're turning your soil, which has a structure, which is like it's built. It has this built structure that roots can get into and moisture can get into and oxygen can move through, and you're turning it into a fine, fine powder by tilling it. And you're also creating a hard pan underneath where the tiller won't go. And that means, basically, you've destroyed the structure of the soil and things will be worse than it was before you did it. How do you deal with that? Well, there are tools that are available in Europe and other places that are smarter. But we use a fork, and it works really well. Broad forks work really well. It's better, but the fact of the matter is, don't undo your yard simply because you have armadillos. Deal with the divots. Armadillos are going to come and go. They're not going to be there forever. If the armadillos are driving you crazy, they don't really pass. They don't like even a low fence is good enough to keep. And by low, I mean 12 inches, 18 inches high. You can usually stop an armadillo just by directing them away from your lawn. You could put one of those little wire, pretty wire fences right around the edge of your lawn until the armadillos decide to back off and go somewhere else. Make sure they're not digging a hole in your flower beds and getting into your lawn that way. But it's pretty easy. They'll move somewhere else. But no, do not till up the... That's all I can say is it doesn't make any sense to do that at all. If you've got problems with your lawnmower scuffing those holes after you pull the divots back in, which is very easy to do. All you got to do is just take a little rake, rake it back in, stomp it with your foot, and then don't mow low. You should not mow low. Don't mow low. If you're mowing low enough that the armadillo divots are causing you problems, you're mowing too low for the grass. So most grass is going to want to be 3 inches high at least, and really for St. Augustine, 4, 5, even 6 inches high is going to be healthy grass. And you can keep it at 4, 5, or 6 inches high as long as you like. It'll look just like everybody else's grass, except it'll be healthier. Not going to look 6 inches tall. It'll just look lush and green. And if you do that, you're not going to have as much problem with those divots. But go ahead and just deal with the divots. Don't deal with the rest of the lawn. That's about all I can, that's the best I can tell you. You got some other questions, we'll come back. That was you. And let's see, we got another question about lawns. Let's see, we'll come back to that in just a minute. And then we're going to talk about chill hours and the big box stores.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
You know, I'm so anxious to plant these peas, these sugar snap peas. I got so many different kinds of sugar snap peas. I feel like, you know, it makes me feel better just to carry them around in my coat pocket. You know, if you didn't have me all occupied here and I was at church this morning, I would have them in my coat pocket at church just to make me feel better. Listen, this is the time for sugar snaps. It's time to start thinking about planting them if you're on the Gulf Coast. It's a little early if you're farther north. You can call and talk to me about where you are, and we can kind of guess as to what's the best day. I would say the range is sometime between January 6th in the milder areas, or January, 1st in the milder areas, very close to the coast, all the way up to about February 14th around Huntsville. And you're going to fall, your garden's probably going to fall somewhere in between there. Just a reminder to people in Mobile that this is not an on the Gulf Coast, particularly if Gulf Shores, I mean, you better get those peas out. You just don't have a lot of time left. You got to get them out. And they will deal with this cold very well. They'll deal with the cold very well. It's going to warm up this week. It's going to be wet. It's going to be 70 degrees. They're going to germinate like, you snap your fingers. So get them in the ground, folks. Don't play around. Don't play around if you're on the Gulf Coast. You have a little bit of time to play around. I might recommend playing around just a little bit. You can experiment if you live in Huntsville. Let's just say experiment. You never know what the climate's, what the weather is going to do in any one year. So you might actually get lucky. But you also know that there's a high probability that we're going to have another cold snap in February in Huntsville, for example. It's going to be cold enough to maybe even strangle peas. So wait just a little while on most of your peas, but go ahead and plant a few. See what happens. You might get lucky. You might get lucky. They're gonna grow. They're going to get deep roots. They're going to be ready to produce. Get them done now. Don't wait. Don't wait. Jim in Georgetown left a few satsumas on the tree as an experiment. He's going to let me know how they do. He's going to make some more of his famous satsuma habanero hot sauce, which, Jim, I have tried. And it is quite good, I will have to say. It is quite good. I would like to say that I've tried his blueberry wines and other things, but I haven't had a chance yet. we've been tied up. But that habanero satsuma sauce is very good. Jim, I suspect that it would probably be good in the habanero satsuma sauce, even if it's a little frozen. It might not be quite as good fresh, but I'll be interested to see your take on it. If the sell-by date on the package for sugar snap peas is 11/23, is it okay to still use them? You betcha. You betcha. Sugar snaps, peas, they last a long time, even with a lot of abuse. And I will admit that I give my garden seeds a lot of abuse because I don't put them in a climate control situation. And that means they get very humid and often very warm here in my house. And that means some seeds don't last as long as others. But peas, they last a long time. You're fine. You're fine with those. Just go ahead. Let me get back to, we're going to get back to the lawn. One more thing, and I want to be good about this. I want to be a nice guy. So I'm going to try to be a nice guy for a minute here. But I have to tell you that we have to do a little bit of thinking. This was the looking for not necessarily gardening tips, but lawn tips. Very, very interesting point. What is the best way to kill crabgrass in a lawn? The question is. Now, here's my problem. I don't know what crabgrass is. I mean, I know what crabgrass is. I know that there are actually three or four plants that biologists tend to agree that we could call crabgrass, and they're very different. There's a tropical crabgrass. Southern crabgrass. There's digitalis something else or another. And there's about four or five of them out there. They're all a little bit different. They all behave fairly differently, except that anything that's called crabgrass by these scientists is going to be an annual. That's important. And so the best way to cut to the chase is if it truly is a crabgrass, or even if it's goosegrass, if it's truly a crabgrass, the only reason you've got it, there's only one reason you have it. And that's because there was a bare spot in your lawn already where the seed could germinate. And it's really interesting. So I have, in some of my pastures I'm working on, I actually have crabgrass come in. It's a weed. It's a pandemic weed. It grows all over the world now. It's not the worst weed by any means. Bermuda grass, on the other hand, is just fierce. It's terrible. It's horrible. It's terrible. Kogon grass is even worse. Those are bad weeds. Crabgrass is just, at worst, a minor annoyance, and it actually can be beneficial at times, but it's an annual. This is really important. So it has to emerge from seed every year, and if that seed doesn't see the sunlight, it never emerges. It never germinates. And it doesn't really compete well if you've got your lawn mowed normally and your grass is otherwise healthy. Crabgrass doesn't get rid of your grass. The crabgrass comes in when you've gotten rid of the grass because of the way the lawn is being treated or your expectations or whatever. So there it is. And that's the bottom line. I will also tell you, however, to be fair, that a lot of people call many different plants crabgrass, and I'm not sure why. It's like people saying, oh, well, that's a pin oak. And everybody in every city has every homeowner, every neighbor has a different definition for what a pin oak is, and they're not even closely related. It's just a common name that people remember, and so if they see a weed in their garden, they call it crabgrass, maybe because the people on TV are telling them they got to worry about crabgrass, and so you're going to go worry about it. But bottom line is, if it's truly crabgrass, the problem is you've got bare ground that crabgrass is emerging from. And you need to figure out, why is my regular grass not growing there? Second thing you can ask is, do I really care? And that's a fair question, too. You know, it may not be the worst thing in the world, because the trouble to get grass growing evenly is a lot of trouble. And if you got crabgrass there, just mow it. But the third thing is that a lot of things people call crabgrass are not actually crabgrass. And so we need to determine that before we get too far down the road here. A lot of people call St. Augustine. I've had many times when people called in and said, I've got this terrible crabgrass problem. It's growing everywhere in my yard. It's got these long runners. It's really this strong grass. It turns out to be St. Augustine. So there's, it could be goose grass, which is a slightly different thing, but there you go. I need a little more information on that. And I would say for almost any weed, not everyone, but almost everyone, the problem is not that the weed has invaded your yard. The problem is that your grass has died and something's trying to fill the gap. Something's trying to fill the gap. You know, I've burned areas to get rid of various weeds, and what comes back because the ground is bare are the seeds of crabgrass. And it was fine. I prefer it because it's so much easier to deal with than things like Bermuda grass. It's an annual. It won't be there forever. It actually improves the ground where it grows. It won't usually outcompete most things because it doesn't get that tall. It's very mowable. But let's send me a picture or call me, and let's talk a little bit about what it is so we can actually figure out what we got, because we don't know. Chill hours and the big box stores. Yeah, so this is a big thing. A lot of plants, and not all plants. It's not true for citrus, for example. It's not true for bananas. But a lot of temperate zone plants and require, like peaches, like apples, like pears, like blueberries even. They have a persimmons. They have a certain chill hour requirement. They have to get cold for a certain length of time before it triggers their willingness to bloom and set fruit. And if they don't get that number of chill hours, they don't set fruit very well. Those chill hours are, what is a chill hour? You know, it doesn't require great cold. In fact, at 17 degrees, it's really probably not going to record those chill hours. Isn't that odd? So it's like 17 degrees, nothing happened for that plant. It's like it didn't get any chill hours. It was too cold for it to record it. Chill hours tend to occur around between 40 and 50 degrees, basically. And that's when you log your most chill hours, is when the temperature is around 45 degrees. And the more hours around 40 to 45 to 50 degrees, the more likely your plant's going to bloom well if it has a requirement for high chill hours. So if you have something like Alberta peach or Belle of Georgia peach, it's going to have chill hours of close to, let's say 1,000 hours, maybe a little more. We don't get, typically, in downtown Mobile, you're not going to get 400 hours of chill, maybe 500 hours, maybe 600 hours some year. In Gulf Shores, you're going to get maybe 300, 400 hours of chill. So what that means is that if you plant Belle of Georgia in Gulf Shores or Mobile, it's not going to produce, except in an extremely cold year, which we haven't had in a long time. We've had these cold outbreaks, but not the chill hours, not those extended chill hours that you would need to make these things fruit. So when you go to Lowdown Depot and they're going to sell you a fruit tree, and they're going to tell you the absolute truth, aren't they? They're going to tell you exactly how many chill hours that plant needs, and they're not going to sell you a plant that isn't adapted to your yard. Don't be a sucker. They'll sell you anything you'll buy.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Let's get to some of these questions. Don is asking, can he get seeds from his frozen jalapenos that he didn't harvest? Probably. do you really want to do that? That's a good question. They may or may not turn out to be exactly like their parents. It may have been a hybrid jalapeno, and you don't know exactly what you're going to get as a result. So, I don't want to go into all that. But let me just say, you need to determine whether it was a jalapeno hybrid or not. If it wasn't a hybrid, there's a chance that you might get a jalapeno that was very similar to the one you had last year, because that means it's been selected to essentially pollinate itself, and which means it's going to reproduce with itself, and it means it's going to be pretty much identical to last year's jalapeno. So there it is. Can you still use seeds? Yeah, I don't think it'll be any problem. Rusty is asking, in Mossport, can you start them? But Rusty, let's back up a second. There are a lot of kinds of radishes, and they're basically, let's put them in two groups, two big broad groups. One is a group of radishes that produce relatively quickly in spring. I mean, and I'm talking about like 25 days, 20 days. It's amazing how fast they can produce. And they are not daylight sensitive. They seem to produce just like drop of the hat. They are out there producing their roots at a drop of the hat. On the other hand, the radishes that I get, and they're small, they're smaller radishes for the most part, but there's a lot of cool ones out there. Look around for them. They're the spring radishes. They're going to have a very short time to produce, generally in 30 days. But make sure you don't plant fall radishes in spring. And there are a lot more fall radishes than there are spring radishes. And those fall radishes, Rusty, you may know this, but let me bore everybody else with this. Those fall radishes, they require declining days. They require declining daylight in order to set roots. They don't do well when planted in spring because daylight is increasing. It's just the way they are. So there are a lot of summer and fall planted radishes that will do fine in summer and fall if planted then. Spring is a different set of radishes, a whole different group of radishes. Most of them are those small cherry radishes, but there's some icicle radishes, longer radishes that aren't as big as some of the fall radishes. I think they're quite good too. Nothing wrong with growing those. And the fun part about them is, I mean, you drop them in the ground and boom, you got radishes in no time. I would say this week is a great time to plant those radishes. You know what? Even Rusty, here's the fun part about radishes. Let's say it gets too cold for radishes, and the chances are it won't, actually, even for the spring radishes, which are maybe not quite as hardy. Chances are you're going to make a crop of radishes before that cold weather comes back, even if we have another spell of cold weather. They're just that quick, and they're cheap. I mean, the seed has cost you nothing. So, yeah, go ahead and plant those radishes now. Great time to do it. You could plant some. Here would be the great thing, and this is kind of an old-fashioned way of doing it, and I think it works just fine. Particularly with spring radishes, it works well with spring radishes, better than fall radishes, I have discovered. Plant carrots with your radishes. Plant the carrot seeds and the radishes at the same time, and they'll work really well for you if you do it right now. Don't get a really long season carrot. Get a carrot that produces relatively quickly. Sow it with the radishes. Make sure it stays moist. The radishes are going to pop up. You're going to grow them. You're going to pull them. In between there, those carrots are going to just piddle along. It takes them a long time to germinate. Keep them nice and moist. The radishes will help to keep them moist. And then you pull the radishes, and there are the carrots underneath. And it's a good way of doing it. So think about doing that, Rusty. There you go. What else we got? We did address the chill hours and the big box stores. Let's see, who else have we, did we miss anybody else? You know, I hope, there's only so many ways you can say what the real problem with the lawn is. And no matter how many different ways you look at it and how many different ways you turn it and twist it around, you're basically going to give the same response. Most lawns have problems for, let's say, three or four reasons. The first reason is that huge lawns, huge areas of lawns, are inevitably pest and disease magnets. And we have huge areas of lawn. And in fact, there was a recent study, and I'm gonna write a little bit more about it. Have you ever heard somebody say, oh gosh, you know, the guy, my neighbor next to me is infecting my lawn with so and such weed? And you know, here's the truth. Your lawn is being infected by pests and weeds because your neighbor is growing a lawn identical to you. And he probably has the same, he, she, whatever, has the same problems with the lawn that you do. And because your lawn is identical to the lawn next door, it's just like, I mean, the weeds don't know any different. If you were doing something different than the person next door, if you had a lawn that was significantly different, that wouldn't be happening. And so when I tell you, you know, you can look at some of those alternative lawns, and we should do it more, like liriope. I mean, liriope's out there, but it's not out there right now everywhere. I suppose if it were, it would probably have more disease problems, but liriope works pretty well as a lawn. It's actually constitutionally a little tougher than most grasses. I use the word liriope because you would not like it if I use the word monkey grass, but it's just monkey grass, and it's just fine for grass. It's great. It works really, really well. And, you know, why don't people sell it as grass sod? Because if they did, then you'd never have to replace your grass sod, and they wouldn't make any money. They wouldn't be able to sell you all those chemicals. At any rate, there's a lot of ways to think about grass and lawn, but most of the time it's that we've got too much of it, and that's going to create pests and disease problems that we can't control. The second reason we have problems with lawns, and this is huge, is people mow them too short. A lot of people mow their yards too short, and grass needs light to live. That's how it lives. It's not the nitrogen, it's not the phosphorus, it's not the potassium, it's not the tiller, it's not any of those things. It's sunlight that makes grass live. And if you don't have enough sunlight because you got too many trees, or you don't have enough sunlight because you've cut the grass too short and you've essentially cut off the way that the grass actually absorbs sunlight, you got a big problem, because that grass hadn't got any other way to live. So cutting things too short, not having enough sunlight, that's the second one. We're not going to spend too much time on it, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the other two problems. We'll be back.
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast, with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast sunny morning. Jim's not going outside till 11 o'clock because it was still in the 20s. It's been cold. Some places have been a little colder than others. Jim sent me in a reading of 16 degrees from Georgetown. There's a question mark after that, Jim. And I think I now am interpreting, I wasn't sure how to interpret that. I now understand that that was a degree mark that just didn't translate. But yes, so that's a good reading from Jim's weather station. 16 degrees, that's cold enough to actually probably do a little bit of damage. We'll have to be thinking about it. We'll have to be working on that. So what have we got this morning? We have to talk about lawns every now and then. And the reason I don't want to talk about lawns too much is because we make too much of them. We worry about them too much. Have your lawn, but if you're having to worry about it, you need to do something else. And there's no need that your lawn, this weird thing about lawn perfection, I don't know where it came from. It came from people who are trying to sell you goods. I've been working in lawns for a long time, probably about as long as almost any of you. There's probably a few not worked in lawns quite as long as I have. And by that I mean when I was 8 years old, I was mowing the yard, probably doing it when I was 7. 8's probably fair. And my dad didn't want my 7-year-old self to cut off my toes, but by 8 years old, I was out mowing the yard. And we all learned to mow the yard. And here's the truth. I mean, I can tell you because I looked at those kinds of things. We did have stickers in our yard. I remember, I can tell you. We did have all kind of weird things that weren't Bermuda or Bahia or St. Augustine or Centipede. Honest to goodness, I couldn't even tell you what kind of lawn we had. Nobody could. You just mowed whatever you had. And it would stay green during most of the summer until we had a drought. And everybody was perfectly happy with that. Just some context. Now we've got this crazy idea that somehow we're going to be able to maintain a pure lawn of one sort of grass or another. You're going to drive yourself crazy trying to do that. I'm just telling you. You'll never achieve it. And in trying to get there, you might briefly for a few months actually think you have gotten there until something blows up on you. But the truth is, it's just going to be a pain. You don't need it. You got lots of other things. So don't worry about what's in the grass quite as much as we do now. It's nice to have St. Augustine because it ain't stickers. If you want St. Augustine and not stickers, as I said in the last hour, don't mow so short. There's no way you're going to have stickers. There's almost no way you're going to have a large area of things like crabgrass, assuming it is crabgrass, or goosegrass. You're not going to have those things unless you've got a bare area. And those bare areas usually come, the areas where the soil can see the sun. That's where those seeds are going to germinate. That's where those stickers are going to germinate. That's where the goosegrass is going to germinate. That's where the digitalis, what do you call that? The crabgrass is going to germinate. If you don't have those bare areas, if the soil can't see the sun, you're not going to have huge weed problems for the most part. There's a couple of exceptions. But you're not going to have those kinds of weed problems. So mow your grass higher. That's the key. Mowing it short will actually kill the grass. And I know this because I started mowing grass when I was 8 years old. And honest to goodness, I didn't want the grass to grow. And all I knew was that if I set that mower at like the second level, it didn't grow back. And I didn't have to mow it. And this was a plus. Because, I mean, you know, I'm 8 years old. I got better things to do than mow the grass. You're 60 years old or 50 years old or 40 years old, and surely, no, I'm sure you don't have anything better to do than mow the grass. At any rate, there it is. You got to mow right. It's got to have sunlight. The grass has got to have sunlight, not the weeds. You don't want to mow too low. You create all kind of problems. Let's talk about another problem that affects a lot of lawns, and that is the soil gets very compacted, and it's compacted because the people who built your house wanted it compacted. They think it's a great thing that your soil is compacted. They don't want it to be loose. They don't care about whether you got roots going down into the ground. They don't care about what they do to the trees around your house. So you've got to deal with that compaction. And what that means is you got a hard pan. It's about 3 inches down, between 3 and 7 inches down, and roots can't penetrate it. Water can't penetrate it. Oxygen can't move in and out of it. So it's like a barren zone. And that means your grass has to live in just that top, you know, it's not even as deep as your knuckle, your first knuckle on your thumb. Because that's the only place it can get oxygen. It's the only place there's, and you know what happens? Because there's no reservoir for the water, because the water can't perk into the soil anymore. The lawn dries out very quickly. And because the soil can't drain, when it rains heavily, the soil is like it's flooded because it can't drain. So it goes from this extreme of flood to drought. It's compacted soil. That causes a lot of problems. It's no question that causes a lot of problems. Tilling makes that worse. I don't want to spend all morning talking about it, but people have heard me say it before. Tilling makes it worse because it turns it into a powder, and it means it collapses. And collapses more densely, and it means you got your fragile pan, your hard pan, is even deeper and more resistant. So there are those things to think about when you're thinking about lawns. But the first lesson is, don't stress about the lawn. Just think about it as a way to get from one place in your yard to another. That's what lawns are for. They're not there to be the jewel of your garden. And if you want to make them the centerpiece of your garden, you will always be aggravated. And I just, you know, I don't like talking to aggravated people all the time. So there you go. Have fun with your garden. Let's see. Bruce says busy citrus week in the kitchen, Hamlin orange juice, Satsuma jelly, Myers lemon pie, Hamlin oranges, red navel oranges, Myers lemons, and tangerine. Looks beautiful. Looks beautiful. Oh, that's great looking stuff, Bruce. I used to recommend leaf bags up against citrus to protect them from the cold. I haven't heard anything about that in a while. You know, I always feel bad about repeating myself, but listen, prompt me. I'm glad to repeat myself. Leaf bags can be very useful, and I probably haven't repeated this enough. Leaf bags can be very useful. Here's one of the things I do with leaf bags. One, I dump the leaves on the garden where I want my compost to be, where I want to grow my tomatoes next year. I do that in fall, make a pile about 4 feet high. And even during even these relatively cold winters, it's gonna molder on down. There's gonna be a lot of biological activity in it. If it's not dropping, it's gonna start at 4 feet high, and within a couple of months, it's gonna be 2 feet high, and then within another month, it could be a foot high. So all this biological activity is, and it's converting that to topsoil, and that's a great thing. There's another thing you can do with leaf bags, and that is leave the leaves in the bags. And I find this useful at times. Leave the leaves in the bag. Throw a little fertilizer in there. It could be cottonseed meal. Cottonseed meal is probably great. Does it matter if you put a chemical fertilizer in there? Probably not. Just throw it in there, and then I'm going to tell you what to do with that bag. We'll be back here in just a minute.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, all right, here we go. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Beautiful picture of the white pelicans out on Krebs Lake in Pascagoula this morning. Thank you, George. That was great. Leaf bags. Let's talk about what we're doing with these leaf bags. So I said, you got a bunch of leaf bags. I'm telling you, throw some fertilizer. Why would I tell you to throw fertilizer in the leaf bag and keep the leaves in the leaf bag? Because I'm going to use it to snug up against bananas or citrus or other things. And it won't be just one bag. It needs to be several bags, making kind of a leaf bag fort around your banana plant, those bags tend to give off heat pretty well. And I, you know, I found that they may be as useful as, they may be more useful to do it that way in some ways than simply piling up the leaves around them, which is hard to do, obviously, to any height. But keep them in those leaf bags. I think that can help a lot. You might, on a particularly cold day, you might make a leaf bag for it around your citrus, young citrus, and then throw a tarp around that. Right? I think that would make a lot of difference in terms of its cold tolerance. It's harder on older citrus, but I do think the leaf bags can help. One of the older things that people used to do, and it works very well, is to take soil from the ground and basically connect a pyramid of soil to the ground, and that soil conducts the ground heat pretty well, and it keeps that graft from getting damaged during cold spells. And what you'll end up with in those cases is just a little stub, but at least it'll come back. But I think the leaf bags are probably about as effective. If they're cooking just a little bit, and I found it to be very useful. So there you go. Could you mess it up and it doesn't work as effectively? Probably. But I think it works pretty well. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts. One other thing, leaves should be moist. They need to be a little bit moist. That may be more important than the fertilizer. Throw a little bit of fertilizer. Doesn't need a lot. Just a little bit to get it cooking. Kind of shake it around in there. Stir it around. And it'll start cooking. You'll feel the warmth. It can make a big difference. So there it is. Did I revisit that pretty well? 2722. I tried. So spinach. Does spinach grow here? If so, when do I plant? You know, I need to overcome some of... Spinach is one of those things I never planted a lot of. And I never planted a lot of it because I just... Well, never mind why. You just say, that boy, he don't know what he's talking about. He doesn't have any sense. He should be growing more spinach. And I probably should be growing more spinach. I have grown it a little bit. I can tell you a few things about it. One, it's very finicky about soil temperatures. So it's very hard to get it started in fall. You might get a few seeds to germinate, but you're going to miss germination of a lot of seeds. It germinates better at temperatures around 55 to 60 degrees. Next week is therefore going to be a great time to sow spinach. You can sow it in pots, you can sow it in the garden, however you want to do it, but it is a great time to sow spinach. Spinach also is will go to flower with lengthening days, so you want to do this as quickly as you can. You want to get it in the ground and get it going. It's fairly hardy. It's fairly hardy. It'll probably stand up to most anything you throw at it, but just take a tarp or something to throw over it. Now, as spring develops, if you wait later to plant in spring, if you wait until, say, March, the ground temperatures may already be so warm that you're going to get moderately poor germination, but you're also going to get spinach that doesn't taste as good because air temperatures are too high. So probably now is probably the best time to plant. Thank you for making me think about it, for reminding me to tell people to plant spinach. I would say next week, given what we're expecting for temperatures next week, is going to be a great time to sow spinach. Go ahead and do it. Get it done. Get it done before those temperatures get too high. And while we got a little bit of break, I think, you know, the air temperature is going to be mostly around 50 to 70 degrees during that time. The ground temperature is going to still lag because it's been through this cold spell. And that's probably perfect. That probably means it's just perfect for starting spinach. So go ahead. How's that? Let's see. Don, what you think I'm funny, Don? It does make a lot of sense. I've actually been picking up road trash leaf bags, Don says, bringing them to my farm in Citronelle and staging them in a specific area. The problem is if I leave them too long, the bags, because they have little or no UV protection, they become brittle. Not a problem. I just separate the plastic from the organic matter and leave it there. Yeah, that's right. It's funny how some of us think outside the box. Some people with that knowledge that cannot still it, and those that are not willing to listen to still try. Thank you for not giving up on us. Yeah, thank y'all for not giving up on me. I have all sorts of terrible limitations. Don, it's Don, by the way, is saving seeds from a jalapeno that his granddaddy had. And I think that's a great thing to do. And I think it's going to do just fine. He's asking me, is it true that basil will help to repel pests in the garden? Don, I don't think so. I don't think so. Whatever benefits are there, they're pretty small. Now, I have used, I don't know how successful I was, moderately successful. I've tried to use basil seedlings and other things to clip it off the basil and drop the leaves on plants that I'm worried are going to get predated if something smells them, like carrots and other things. It may help a little bit. I don't think it helps a lot, honestly. But I can tell you that simply companion planting with basil is probably going to have almost no impact on anything you grow. It's just not the case. As nearly as I can tell. Let's see here. We got some other questions. Even though I covered my night blooming cirrus, it seems damaged, pretty bad looking. Dark. Will it come back? Cut it back. Chunk it. I would not chunk it. Jim in Georgetown needs to testify. Be patient. All of these things, be patient. Just be patient. Yeah, so let's talk about covering plants. When you covered that night blooming cirrus, was it still hanging up? Because let me go back to something that I say over and over and over. Plants don't have heat. They are not warm-blooded in the way people are. They don't generate heat very well. And so what you're doing when you put a coat over something or you put insulation around something is basically you're keeping that thing from losing heat. You're not holding out the cold. Somebody in physics, you tell me I'm wrong about this. You're not keeping out the cold. You're delaying heat loss. You're preventing heat loss. Because that hot, those high temperatures are going to move from a warmer surface to a colder area pretty quickly. So that's what insulation does. But what if you're not giving off any significant heat? And plants don't give off significant heat. They have all kind of weird little things that go on with their flowers. Sometimes the flowers will get extra hot. They have some metabolism in their flowers. Skunk cabbage is one of those plants that actually has a weird metabolism thing. But most plants aren't like that. They really, it's just, they just don't have enough heat that simply wrapping the plant makes that much difference, or putting a cover over the plant makes that much difference. The one thing that putting a cover over your night blooming cirrus did was to block some of the wind, and that's good because the wind can desiccate it. It can dry it out, which is what freezing does anyway, and sort of makes that whole process worse, makes it lose heat even faster if it's exposed to the wind. So you helped there, but you didn't help much. So when you've got a night blooming cirrus and you want to keep it from getting cold damaged, take it off the tree. Don't leave it hanging. At least put it on the ground and then cover it. That can make a ton of difference because the ground's got a ton of heat. And if you cover that, cover the plant and the ground around it, you're trapping that ground heat and boom, there you go. You got something. It probably will be enough to help it through most spells. Put it against a house. Put it on the porch against the house. See what I'm saying? So David David's good. I got friends in the physics community. So David Hubble says he agrees completely with the covering the plant statement. Thank you, David. 18 in David's yard. Oh, that's the thing. Citrus leaves appear to be curling. We're going to be back here. We're going to assess more of this coal damage. And we're talking more about spinach, apparently.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face. All right. Let's see what we got. 33 now, just about time to head outside. So I better talk fast. Jim's ready to head outside. The temperature's warming up. We got a little bit left to talk about. what a cool structure C.B. Carl has sent me from his garden in Bon Secours. I'm going to guess he said it should wait a while to put out my tomatoes. Ice all over his tomato cage. It's really quite beautiful. It's quite attractive. I haven't thought about making an attractive sculpture out of my tomato cage with ice, but CB, I think you've done it, and I think it's absolutely beautiful. You should try it again next time it gets this cold. What else? What did we leave off here? Speaking of spinach, so I did say we were going to talk about spinach, didn't I? Listen, New Zealand spinach is one of those things where, you remember what I said when we started the program today, if you happen to be tuned in, and I said, we've got all these people out there saying, we got this horticultural zone map that'll tell you just what to grow, and we're just using one number, and it's going to tell you everything you need to know, and so if it grows in zone 8 in California, it's going to grow in zone 8 in Mobile. And folks, well, Mobile ain't zone 8 anymore according to this map, but folks, let me tell you, that ain't so. And New Zealand spinach, it's really funny. You go on the internet, and I've been there too, and I'm thinking, oh wow, this is a spinach that really likes hot weather. New Zealand spinach, it really likes, you know, it's going to be great. There are many definitions for hot weather. And let me tell you, New Zealand spinach does not like our definition of hot weather. It probably does okay in California, where the daytime temperatures are pretty hot, the nighttime temperatures cool off, does fine. It hates humidity, as nearly as I can tell. It hates high rainfall. It would probably do just fine in fall conditions when a lot of other greens are also going to do just fine. But no, I haven't. Now, that said, if you want to try New Zealand spinach to prove that I'm a total idiot, I think this is the best thing in the whole world. Because you know what? Half my life, I'm a total idiot. So I could be wrong here, and I may have done something wrong, and I may not have held my lips right when I did this. So I want you to think about it. It won't cost you much. You tell me how it does. I will tell you my experience is I'm not going to try it again. But that's okay. I could be wrong. And you need to try it. But the one thing to remember is that when someone, we don't get our information locally anymore. We get our information from someplace in Michigan or California or Boston or England or wherever, because it's on the internet, and they're gonna say this loves hot weather. And when somebody in Utah or California says this plant loves hot weather, you say uh-oh, because Utah ain't Alabama, U-T-A-H, not E-U-T-A-W. Utah ain't Alabama, California is not Alabama, Michigan is not Alabama. And so you have to be a little bit leery about that, because you think maybe they don't really understand heat the way we understand heat. And our heat is latent heat. For all you physics buffs out there, it's the humidity. It's the heat that won't go away. And that's the problem. That makes it very different. It's not the high temperatures during the day that's the problem. Usually it's the high temperatures at night. And it's often the rainfall But I have not had good luck with that. Let's see what else. Evan in Grand Bay, what time is the best time to cut back muscadines? That's a good and fair question. My wife was asking me that very question this morning, not as a, you know how that is. I'm just wondering, when's the right time to cut back muscadines? And you know what that means. It means you better get out there and get to it. Because I had some good grapes and some good muscadines, and she wants them, and she wants me to make sure I'm doing it, and so she's asking as politely and as pointedly as she knows how. So, yes, it doesn't hurt to do it now. I would wait generally a little bit later, but there's no reason. You can do it now. I think with muscadines, we don't see the problem of leafing out too early the way we do with some other plants. And that's one of the problems with pruning too early. But I think we're okay. I actually, if I had my druthers, I would wait until probably wait till the second week in February. Just because there's less of a problem of heavy pruning forcing the leafing out. But now is probably okay. If you're running out of time and you don't have time that second week in February, you can go ahead and do it now. And that's good. And probably it's going to be okay. Next week will be a fun time to be in the garden. You might want to go ahead and do it while you're out there. I may have to do it next week. Sounds like that was the message I was getting. So we'll think about that. Is there a local Facebook group for native plants that might have or be willing to have a page for swapping native seeds? Maybe that could be a way to set this up. Everybody knows how good I am on Facebook. Not everybody. But I ain't good on Facebook. I'm not sure. I haven't seen a Facebook page devoted to that. Haven't seen it, but it's worth thinking about, and maybe somebody can weigh in. And next week, if somebody wants to set up a Facebook page, has got some information, you let me know about it. We'll set it up. Exchanging native seeds, and we'll have to define what native seeds are. Y'all get to define it, I guess. All right. Next Guffernon question. How much do you take off? Ooh. A lot. You know, one of the things about pruning scuppernongs, muscadines, same thing essentially. There are the same species. They're just slightly different color variations. Gets a little complicated when you're doing common names, but they're the same thing. And grapes, is that you have to take off to make them productive. You have to take off so much that it'll scare you. If you ain't scared when you're taking it off, Jim, you hadn't taken off enough. That's the simple story. What you're trying to get, it depends on which kind of grape and muscadine you have. You're trying to get back to some active spurs that are last year's growth. You're cutting those back. You're wanting them to produce from those last year's spurs. And that means you got to cut out a whole bunch of stuff. And by the time you're through, you won't have any long branches at all. Everything should be very clustered along the wire where you did it. Now, if you've got it on an arbor, there ain't an easy way to do it. And you just kind of say, okay, whatever happens is what happens. And over time, arbors become less productive for muscadines because they're just such a tangle, and because you just can't control it, and you're getting more disease and you're getting more problems. So arbors for muscadines are probably not the best idea in the world if you really want muscadines. If you just want shade, that's fine. But if you're growing them on a trellis, a wire trellis, and there are several ways to grow them on a wire trellis. I have my druthers, but, you know, there's a lot of ways to do it. But it's a wire trellis, and what you'll do is prune it so that basically there's almost nothing left except a few little stubs from that central vine that's run along the trellis wires. And I'll tell you what, next week we're gonna have a session on pruning muscadines. I promise that will be the thing. Pruning muscadines, pruning grapes. I shouldn't have promised that, but I did, and I'm going to follow through. And next week we're going to try to describe it on the air, and exactly how to do it. And that will be a good refresher course for me, because obviously someone in my household is trying to light a fire under me to get those scuppernongs and muscadines and grapes pruned here in the next couple of weeks. I've got a tall, shiny, wild persimmon next to a giant cypress. Can I prune it to make it more like a bush? Berry. Probably. But why? And what would you accomplish by doing that? So here's the trick. You're probably going to preclude any persimmons. And persimmons trees, wild persimmons, sprout like the dickens. So I guarantee when you prune it back, you're going to get a bunch of little sprouts, you know, 10 or 15 sprouts in an area. It could be over 30 feet. You're going to see sprouts coming up all over the place, because pruning it back sort of puts in the old defensive mechanism that this plant has to start sprouting from its roots, which it's already doing a little bit, but it's going to make it much worse. So I wouldn't. You could. It probably would survive, but only in the worst possible way. You're not going to get fruit. You're going to create a hazard, a nuisance. And no, don't do that. So what are you going to do if it's sitting next to the cypress? Well, I guess what you could do, if it's too close to the cypress, you can try to prune it back and see if the sprouts develop from that root system farther away from the cypress. This is would be a tricky thing, and I'm not sure you're going to pull it off. But you could say, okay, I'm going to cut this stem back and see if I get a sprout that's farther away from where the cypress was, and I'll let that sprout grow because it's farther away from the cypress and see what I get out of it. Yeah. Now, this is harder than it seems. One of the first problems is, you got to remember, persimmons have both male and female. And wild plants, about 50% at least of the wild population is male. Sometimes they change sex. Yes, they do. Because they're not as particular about it as we are, apparently. So they will change sex. But mostly they're going to be, if they're male, they're going to stay male, and it's going to be 50 or 60% chance that it's going to be a male, and you're not going to get any fruit out of it. So just be aware of that. That's kind of the first thing. And the second thing is, it's going to take a while. Going to take a while before you get fruit. Yeah, I can't get to the fruit now anyway, so you could try what I suggested and see how it works. You know, you might also think about getting a wild persimmon that is known to be a female. We'll talk about that later.
Because everything is on the phone, you know you got to go. I'll get down on your bending.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, a couple quick things. Let's see if we can get through this. Somebody said, I substitute sweet potato vine leaves for spinach during summer, and what a great idea. It's very traditional, by the way, in a lot of cultures to use sweet potato leaves. And some taste better than others, but it's worth thinking about. They all taste pretty good, but you can definitely use the leaves of sweet potatoes as a substitute for most spinach uses. Do you cook your sweet potato leaves, or do you eat them raw? I don't know. We'll talk about that next week. We'll have more time. That's a fun thing to talk about. Let's see. There is we've got a lot of information about a native seed page, and there is a Lower Alabama Native Seed Society. I would love to see more members and swap some of the seeds I have. I'm a proud member. I see that my plain gardening For the Gulf Coast, Wonder Wheel is used as a symbol on that page. It's good to know that it has been, it has become part of our culture, because I think it's useful, our culture literally and figuratively. It's a useful thing, that plain gardening wheel. We're going to talk a little bit more about that next week. I'll see what I can find about those things and what they're doing, but somebody may want to set up another group that's dedicated more to just the native seeds. We'll see. I have a unique situation over my chicken coop with muscadines and scuppernongs. Yeah, I could see where it's going, and you know that's good. That's good. But it can be hard to prune them. I really can't help you on a pergola. It's really hard to do that. What else have we got? There was another thing. Could you please clarify something? So I talk a lot about monkey grass and liriope and mondo grass, and my good friend Chris, Chris Francis and I agree on many, many things. Chris always says, you know, you need to be telling people to grow mondo grass because it really is developed as a short ground cover-like thing. The problem with mondo grass is that it grows very slowly, and it's a different species, mondo grass, Ophiopogon. Looks different, has black fruit rather than those blue fruits. It's a lot of differences, and it's very thin leaves, and it rarely gets more than a foot high. Mr. Dodd had a mondo grass that was, I think he claimed to be the slowest and smallest mondo grass on the market. And you can only imagine what kind of marketing potential it has. Yeah, this is the slowest, smallest thing you could possibly plant. Yeah, it didn't work. And that's the problem with mondo grass, is that it is slow and it is small. Monkey grass, on the other hand, is liriope. It tends to have broader leaves, slightly broader leaves, and bluish flowers. There are many cultivars, many different types. There's one that gets really big. I wouldn't recommend using that one for your lawn grass, but just a regular old monkey grass that people have, it's different. It's got broader leaves than mondo grass, slightly different flowers, different fruit, but it's monkey grass I recommend because it grows so prolifically. Neither one are true grasses. They're both more closely related to lilies than to grasses, but they work really well. They're really tough. They're really neat things in the yard. Does that help? I would say that you sent me some pictures, and I would say there's the one on the left is definitely liriope. The one on the right is probably mondo grass. I can't tell whether it's been mowed or not. I don't have a really big picture of it, but it probably is. So, yes, there we go. So what any other questions that I didn't get to today? What time? I did do pretty well at getting to a lot of these questions. So there you go. It's getting to be planting time, and I did say, just for those of you who are interested in gardening, it's time to get your peas out. It's time to start your tomatoes. I do remind you of this. I do feel like I repeat myself a lot, but that's what I'm here for. Just to remind you, it's getting to be that time, and you're going to feel like it next week. You're going to get a spate of warm weather. It's fine. You go right ahead. Now, don't put your tomatoes in the garden yet. I think it's way too early. But you can start your seeds now, and you definitely need to start your seeds. It's probably on the Gulf Coast, this will be really your last chance to start seeds for tomatoes and have them produce in a timely way. So go ahead and do that next week as soon as you possibly can. Get those in the ground, get them growing, get them up to size. Your peas, just a fine time to grow them, great time to do it. I think it's probably just as fine to put out a lot of winter greens as well. Things like kale, if you want another crop of kale, I think it's a good time to put out collards. I think it's a good time to put out not the best time, but a good time to put out collards. It's a fine time to put out short season cabbages. It's a great time to put out broccoli if you've got some broccoli that's ready to go. It's a great time to put out arugula and parsley. All those things are going to do just fine. If it gets a little cold, you just cover them. Carrots and radishes. That's a great thing to use. It's a good thing to do right now. So, good. Next week, if all these people, next week, if all of you who wrote in today, late in the show, to say that we would love to set up a native seed exchange, Anna did and some other folks, let's call me back next week. Let's get the show cranked up early and let's get to talking about it. Let's try to figure out how we do it. Let's have somebody besides me do some talking. Don't you get tired of hearing me all the time? Give me a call next week. And let's talk about how to do a seed exchange of native plants, how that would work, how to set it up on Facebook. Can we do that? Anna, will you be there? And some of you other folks who wrote in? 6323, Jesse in Satsuma. Jesse says he's got the Lower Alabama Plant Society. Do we want to use that as a way to exchange native seeds? It's all an interesting question. So let's think about it. Anna has some real needs. She wants to sponsor a high school club in Mobile that is trying to do it. And so we'll go from there. That'll be next week. And next week I also have the immense challenge of helping you try to prune your muscadines and your grapes, which is something, boy, I'm going to be doing too. So let's talk about that next week. We'll go through it step by step. We're looking at the spurs. I'm going to have to think about all the different types of grapes you may have and think about exactly how each one needs to be pruned. And all your different muscadines. I want to think about all that. I want to think about as many ways as I can how you've got your grapes set up, and we'll figure that out. So that'll be two big tasks next week, figuring out how we exchange seed and how we do muscadines and scuppernongs. Meanwhile, get your peas planted. We'll be back.